And our preaching text today is Romans 9, 30 to 33. Page 946 in your pew Bible. What shall we say then? That Gentiles who did not pursue righteousness have attained it, that is, a righteousness that is by faith. But that Israel, who pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, did not succeed in reaching that law. Why? Because they did not pursue it by faith, but as if it were based on works. They have stumbled over the stumbling stone, as it is written, "Behold, I am laying in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and whoever believes in him will not be put to shame." When the world looked at a certain piece of marble from a Florentine quarry in the last half of the 15th century, all who saw it saw that piece of marble as a weak piece of stone with an outstanding flaw. In fact, two early artists tried to create something from that piece of marble, but gave up. Agostino di Duccio. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Agostino di Duccio wanted to use it to make a giant statue of a biblical prophet as a buttress for a Florentine cathedral, but he found it impossible to work with. Another sculptor, Antonio Rossellino, appropriated it for his own purposes, which are unknown now, but he found it impossible to work around this flaw in the marble. He, too, abandoned it to the quarry heap. In 1501, Michelangelo took a look at this piece of marble. It had been languishing for some 25 years since Rossellino rejected it. And Michelangelo promised to use it to carve a figure of his choosing without diminishing its size, that is, avoiding the flaw that way, or adding other pieces of marble to it, which was another technique to hide a flaw. One art historian cynically says Michelangelo most likely took it because it was unused and it was free. I prefer to think that Michelangelo enjoyed the challenge of working with this piece of marble. His philosophy of sculpture was different from his predecessors. Instead of seeing a piece of marble as a blank piece of stone, Michelangelo felt, and I quote him, "My subject is in that piece of stone. All I must do is chip away the excess and reveal it." That was his approach to sculpting. Well, he ended up spending 3 years carving his most famous piece, David, right? Now displayed in the Academy Gallery in Florence, Italy. It's rumored that Michelangelo never liked to give away his techniques and his secrets, but it's rumored that the flaw in the stone rested on the figure's chest, which Michelangelo spent months isolating and then chipping it off in a very skilled maneuver. Genius. In any case, what resulted was the world's most celebrated sculptor, if not its finest piece of sculpture, known to every high school student of art history, right? We all know. We've seen images of David, if not the actual statue itself. The stone, rejected by the architectural and artistic world of Michelangelo's day, became the very cornerstone of true art, if I can put it that way. What no one else saw in it, Michelangelo envisioned and executed. And we can say the same thing about Christ in our text today. The very stone of the new covenant, cornerstone of the new covenant, rejected by the stewards of the old covenant, the Jews, has become the chief cornerstone of God's heavenly temple. Peter reflects on that. We are living stones in that temple, are we not? Christ is the living cornerstone of that temple. Unlike those who should have recognized this, the Gentiles, the one that one would think would be the ones to reject Christ, these same Gentiles have responded to him in faith. That's us. To this textual tradition, we've sampled that textual tradition, have we not, in our readings today, to this textual tradition of the cornerstone, the chief stone, we now turn. As we look at our text, 2 points I have for you. On the inside flap of your bulletin, you'll find a brief outline with space for notes. 2 points I want to make with you today. First of all, stumbling stone. That is our title, stumbling stone. The very righteousness Israel stumbled, attaining by works, the Gentiles achieved through faith. That very righteousness that Israel stumbled at, attaining by works, the Gentiles achieved through faith. Now, just a note on its placement here, our text today. Early students of Romans felt Paul begins a new section in chapter 10, since in several other sections he begins with personal reflections, like he does in chapter 9. And he does this in chapter 10, if you look ahead just a little bit. But his new subject actually begins here. His new subject. That is, Christ as the central focus of explanation for why Gentiles have responded in faith and thus attained unto a righteous standing before God. And Christ as the central focus of explanation for why Israel has responded in unbelief and thus are left standing with their own miserable self-righteousness before God and His Torah. Chapter 10 and 11 will unfold this in greater detail. We also know that Paul is fond of commencing new trains of thought with his classic rhetorical question, what shall we say then? You know, he's been doing this all through his letter, hasn't he? What shall we say then? And then he'll launch into a new topic. Well, that train of thought has left the station now with these verses. And he's moving to his larger argument, too, for God's wondrous, mysterious, glorious, sovereign will in the history of redemption. Begun in verse 1 with his own personal angst, right, at Israel's rejection of the Torah's true preoccupation, Jesus Christ. The Torah's true preoccupation is not with law and obedience to rules, so on and so forth that we hear so often. The Torah's true preoccupation and obsession is Christ. And Paul brings that out. All of the apostles rejoice in this, glory in this, do they not? So, as we move through these remaining chapters, remember, chapters 9, 10, and 11 are dealing primarily with why God has rejected Israel, embraced the Gentiles, why there's just a remnant of Jews, why the gates are open now and the Gentiles are flooding into the life of the church. So this interplay between Israel and Gentile, Torah and righteousness, faith and works, and most of all, the centrality of Christ to it all. These are all woven by Paul into a marvelous, cogent tapestry of God's unfolding of redemptive history. So, Paul answers his own question. What shall we say then? As to what should be said in response to God's sovereign will in election. Remember, we're thinking we can place one thought after another. We can place one thought in context with another. We can chew concrete and walk on gum at the same time. Can we not? So he is following up in response to his unfolding of God's sovereign will and election in the previous chapter 9. And what he tells us basically here in these verses is that clueless Gentiles have the map to the fountain of youth, if you will. They have it fall into their lap while Jews who spent their lives and fortunes hunting for that map miss it altogether. Now, if Christ is the perfect righteousness of the Torah, we'll establish that on a firmer basis next week, that Christ is indeed the perfect righteousness of the Torah. And thus, Christ is the source of eternal life, that fountain of youth, if you will. Then the path to it, the map to it, if you will, the path to it is faith and not works. And this God has sovereignly given to the Gentiles this map, this life of faith, in order to fulfill his promises. Now, I say Gentiles were clueless. That's a rather loose interpretation. The Gentiles were clueless because Paul frames this as a pursuit and attainment paradigm, doesn't he, in these verses? Jews pursue. The Gentiles are happily going their own way, whistling in the dark, are they not? They were not pursuing a first place trophy or a gold medal, if we can put it that way, the Gentiles, as were the Olympic Jews. But suddenly these Gentiles find themselves on the medal stand or being handed the Lombardi trophy at the Super Bowl. And it strikes envy in the Jews' hearts. We'll see that. Paul will establish that point too, right? The Jews are envious. In fact, Paul hopes that God will provoke their hearts to further envy and drive them to Christ. Well, nevertheless, in the context of our chapter now, this was God's plan. Paul is not scratching his head and saying, look what happened. Boy, God really blew it, didn't he? No, this was God's sovereign plan. We saw that established earlier in chapter 9. And Paul will elaborate on this even more as we move into chapters 10 through 11. Much to say about grace for us, too, as we move through those chapters. That is, although they did not pursue that elusive trophy of righteousness, they did attain it, these Gentiles. And did so by exercising faith, not by taking on the burden of the Jewish law. In contrast, as we've observed consistently all through this book, Israel had been training in the gym and the pool and the track all of her life, if we could put it that way, having the worship and the oracles of God, but they came up short trophy-wise. Though Israel pursued a law that would lead to righteousness, as Paul puts it, that is, an acceptable obedience to the demands of Torah, she didn't succeed in reaching that, did she? And Paul says, reaching that law, not righteousness, too. Notice that in your text. Did not succeed in reaching the law, that law. Now, Paul puts it this way because his fellow Israelites saw the achievement of the Torah, obedience to the Torah, as the way to righteousness. As they do still today, do they not? The more or less perfect keeping of the commandments, the more or less perfect observance of the festivals of Israel, the more or less perfect exercise of temple worship, the more or less perfect keeping of the some 613 rules. Now, this was deduced very early in the life of Israel. There's 613 rules deduced from the Torah drawn up by the Pharisees. That this would guarantee a righteous status before God. If anybody could be a do-gooder, a good enough do-gooder, it would be Paul. Remember? He reflects on this often in his letters, too. Reaching the law meant attaining righteousness through the law, obedience to the law. And this is the default setting in the human soul, isn't it? Every world religion in the world has some variation, some form of this at its heart. That my obedience, that my goodness, great or small, will indeed guarantee me entrance into heaven if it reaches that level. Biblical Christianity is the only exclusive world religion that says you can never attain righteousness, perfection, for God, and that demands an exalted view of God, a holy, transcendent view of God as well. That you, as a performer of righteousness, can never perform righteousness to that level and that standard. Only the righteousness of another can do this. Once again, it's important to keep in mind, if we step back and take maybe a helicopter view of this book for us just a second, keep in mind that this is also part of the sustained argument for the righteousness of God. That is our summary of the book of Romans. Romans is a sustained argument for the righteousness of God. What it is, why we need it, how we acquire it, and then how we live it out afterwards. And this is part of that sustained argument for the righteousness of God, which you may not feel so important. Hurry up, Pastor, it's hot. I've got a roast in the oven, and I need to get home. Tigers are playing today. These are the things that are important to me. Well, when you stand before God on that great day of judgment, you'll be saying, man, I wish I had gotten my righteousness in order before I got here. Because that is what is important to God. That is what he will require of you on that day. The whole book of Romans says this, demands it, requires it. So, while you still have time, get your righteousness in order, because you will need it on that day. So, Romans being a sustained argument for the righteousness of God, that no man's native righteousness is acceptable to God because of its inherent imperfection, and that only a perfect, whole, and complete righteousness is acceptable before a holy, perfect, transcendent God. We saw in chapter 9 that most people have no clue as to the God with whom they have to do, how sovereign he is, how righteous and holy he is, and what he demands of you. Each individual sinner must therefore appropriate for himself the perfect, whole, and complete righteousness of somebody else. He doesn't have it himself, so he's going to need someone else's righteousness to stand in his place, to adorn himself with, if he is to be found holy, perfect, righteous, and complete. Well, then you may ask, whose righteousness could possibly fill the bill? My mom or dad's. How about mom or dad's? Yeah, let me borrow their righteousness. They're not doing much with it these days. No, I'm afraid they're in the same boat we are. How about some great men of history? Certainly George Washington's righteousness is better than mine. But that's going to fall short too, isn't it? Because he's one of us. Well, then how about Muhammad? Well, we've seen after a study of the life of Muhammad, right? That ain't even going to come close. Buddha, Mother Teresa. No, they are as well in the same boat we are. Now, Paul has been clear all through the book of Romans that there is an exclusivity to the righteousness that he requires. He has provided a way for us. We say, well, why not Islam? Why not Buddhism? Why not some other world, New Age religion? Those are fine with me. Yeah, but they are not with God. He has provided a way, an exclusive way to this righteousness, access to this righteousness. Paul has been telling us all through Romans, has he not? He says in chapter 3, for example, what we require is the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ. The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ is the way that he has provided for you to be endowed with a perfect, holy, glistening righteousness for all who believe. Okay, that's my object. That's where I'm going for. I'm going for the gold, Pastor. How is this righteousness acquired? How do I get this righteousness? How do I endow myself with it? Well, there's a flaw in what I just said. Endow myself with this righteousness, right? Do I cross some great river? Do I climb some high mountain? Maybe if I slay a mighty dragon. No. Most of us couldn't do that stuff anyway. Only the great heroes of mythology do those kinds of things, right? Well, then maybe I can be a good person like Gandhi or Mother Teresa. Well, you read their biographies and they weren't all so hot either. They're one of us, too. No. Not only has Paul just told us here in verse 31 that the Gentiles have attained it by faith, that is the means by which you acquire the righteousness of God, by faith and faith alone, Paul has been telling us, has he not? Paul has consistently asserted this throughout his letter, right? The verse we just read, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe, not for all those who slay dragons. But it is also not a bare faith. People, pastors, others who want to make people feel good say, well, just have faith. Faith in what? Oh, just have faith. Faith in faith. It's not a leap into the dark or the void either, like existentialist philosophers would tell us. I had a pastor who preached existential philosophy rather than the gospel. One reason I was off the rails for 10 years. No, it's not a leap into the dark. It's not a bare faith in faith. There is a definite object to that faith. And the problem for Israel is this, ultimately, the object of that faith. Well, then who or what is that object of faith? That brings us to point two, verses 32 and 33, stumbling stone. The very stone of stumbling for Israel has become the cornerstone for the Gentiles. The very stone of stumbling for Israel has become the cornerstone for the Gentiles. What a ubiquitous metaphor this is, isn't it? It's all through Scripture. We haven't even covered nearly all of the places where this metaphor is employed. And it's apt. Because with it, Paul brings round to our attention the centrality of Christ. The centrality of Christ for righteousness. Not individual performance or national performance to the standards of the Torah for righteousness. Paul asked why. Why did they not reach that law? Israel. Why did Israel not reach that law? And he says, because they did not pursue it by slaying dragons, climbing mountains, and crossing rivers. No, he doesn't say that. Because they did not pursue it by faith in Jesus Christ. Implicit there. But as if it were based on works. They pursued it as if it were based on works. It ain't really. That's that, the intent of that. As if. As if one could reach righteousness by one's own works. Is that coming through for you? Boy, I hope that does. If nothing else comes through to you in this message, you cannot do enough good works to be righteous. You cannot be righteous by your own works. Only the righteousness that God offers, the righteousness from heaven, as he says in chapter 1. And that appropriated by believing. Is that all I got to do? Yeah, well, there's more involved in faith and believing than might first appear on the surface. But that is it to begin. It is crucial to keep in mind that the mode of acquisition here as well, the mode of acquisition, faith, the mode of acquisition of Christ's righteousness has always been faith, even under the old covenant. Important to establish, especially in this religious day, in this country. There's a bifurcation oftentimes, a dichotomy made between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Not so when it comes to appropriating the righteousness of Christ. It is always has been and always will be by faith. 2 Kings 17 says, the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your fathers and that I sent to you by my servants and the prophets. So obedience is necessary. Doesn't mean we become throw the law away. That doesn't mean that we throw righteousness away, the commandments of Christ away. The text goes on to say, but they would not listen, but they were stubborn, as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. There is faith. They did not believe in the Lord their God. So Paul is not pitting the Old Testament mode of acquiring righteousness. He's not pitting it against a new and hitherto unseen mode of acquiring righteousness, that is faith. by pitting the Old Testament against the New, works and law in the Old, faith and righteousness in the New, you commit heresy. You really do. It's an old heresy, first seen prominently by Montanus in the 2nd century BC, Montanism. He drew a sharp distinction between the Old Testament and New Testament, with the Jews saved by works over here and the New Testament people by faith over here. He even went so far as to posit two different gods in each of these covenants. And while not nearly as radical, I would submit to you that dispensationalism, especially the early kind of Scofield Reference Bible dispensationalism, also teaches that God had two different programs, one for Israel, one for the church, with two different modes of being justified. That is, works in the Old Testament and faith in the New Testament. This is why one of the reasons why dispensationalism is so pernicious. It also gives us an unknown, hitherto unseen eschatology with Revelation Red Heifer Rapture teachers all around us. Dispensationalism, or the old dispensationalism, teaches that faith was for Gentiles, works for the Jews. And texts like ours before us today are used as proof texts. When taken out of context, you can make any text a proof text. But that is not what Paul is saying here, is he? Now, if we remember our sustained argument idea, that Romans is a sustained argument for the righteousness of God, we remember that Paul has made the case that righteousness has always been acquired by faith, hasn't he? Always been acquired by faith. And he uses the template for Israel, that is Abraham, as his prime example. Abraham believed God, that is, he exercised faith in God, and it was counted to him as a righteousness, right? It was counted to him. That's imputation. The counting of righteousness that isn't inherently one's own unto one. The counting, the imputation of Christ's righteousness to us is how that is phrased. So, as the Israelite, then, in the Old Testament, practiced his revealed religion, celebrating the festivals of Israel, studying and obeying the principles and precepts of the Torah, worshiping in the temple and in the synagogue, he exercised faith in the coming promised Messiah, to whom all of this pointed. The Torah is in love with Christ. The Torah points to Christ. Torah lives and breathes Christ, just as Christ lived and breathed the Torah. Who lived the Torah like Christ? You want to see the Torah alive as it should be exercised in every circumstance of life? Read the Gospels, and you will see the Torah come alive in the person of Christ, even as the Torah lives and breathes Christ. So as the Israelite in the Old Testament exercised faith in the coming promised Messiah, to whom all of the Torah pointed, he was saved like us. Christ was in every element of his worship when done with these things in mind. Righteousness has always, only, and ever been acquired by faith. Not only the scriptures, as we have just reviewed for you, but also our standards. The Westminster Confession of Faith puts it so beautifully this way. It says, all those things that we just talked about in terms of the Old Testament, all for signifying Christ to come, which were, for that time, sufficient and efficacious through the operation of the Spirit to instruct and build up the elect in faith in the promised Messiah. He's talking about the Old Testament, not just in the But it is, in the end, the object of this faith with which Israel has its problem, Jesus Christ, even today. Paul employs a powerful metaphor from the Old Testament to illustrate this for us, that are the cornerstone of a building, right? And he combines two verses from Isaiah, and there's a whole debate about his conflating or combining or coercing or citing from memory. And if you want to read about a 20-page dissertation on this, I'll loan it to you. But, you know, as I tell you time and again, I read this stuff so you don't have to. But he combines two verses from Isaiah 8:14 and Isaiah 28:16, if you want to sort through those, in order to make his point. Isaiah 8:14 says, "And he will become a sanctuary and a stone of offense and a rock of stumbling to both houses of Israel, a trap and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem." And then from Isaiah 28:16, "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am the one who has laid a foundation in Zion, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. Whoever believes will not be in haste," unquote. So that's why I talk about a textual tradition of the idea of the cornerstone, the chief stone, the capstone we read in one passage. A solid textual tradition every Jew would be familiar with, every Bible student, Gentile or Jew, would be familiar with by the time he gets to Paul. And this metaphor works so perfectly, doesn't it? Why it's ubiquitous. It works so perfectly because a cornerstone not only becomes the chief bulwark of stability and orientation for the rest of the building. You go outside, look to your right, you'll see the cornerstone of this building, 1947, prominently displayed on it. Still, Masons use the cornerstone as the orientation stone as they build the rest of the building. So for the believer then, Christ becomes this chief bulwark of stability and orientation as the spiritual house is built. He being that chief cornerstone, we being the living stones of which the rest of that temple is comprised. But this cornerstone also then at the very same time serves as a good picture of what happens when one inadvertently trips over a rock or stone. Right? Become the basis for a lot of slapstick comedy, somebody tripping and falling, right? It is kind of funny. Can you laugh at yourself when you trip and fall? I was coming down the stairs the other night, dark in the house. I've done it a million times, and I slipped and fell. I'm glad nobody saw it. Debbie got up, jumped out of bed, said, "Are you all right?" No broken bones, but I had to chuckle a little bit because it looked pretty silly and foolish, stumbling over a stone. The idea here, falling and not getting up. The one and the same stone can be a glory and strength to one and an offense and cause of stumbling to another. So it is with Christ. The author of Hebrews elaborates like no one else. He elaborates extensively on this metaphor. Let's turn over there. Hebrews chapter 2 for just a minute. And because we won't be coming back to this image too often as we move through Romans. The author of Hebrews chapter 2. Nope, I'm sorry. That's not where that occurs, is it? We'll come to that later then. The author of Hebrews does elaborate extensively on the metaphor. I guess this is God's way of saying it's hot. Let's shorten the sermon a little bit, okay? But as then the stone of stumbling, who at one instance saves and shows us how God then builds his house of living stones, and can also be at the very same time a stone of stumbling for those who are fallen, for those who are non-elect. Christ then becomes the one who acts as the precipitator of men, who separates out the sheep from the goats, does he not? Being at the very same time a stone of blessing, cornerstone for us, and a stumbling stone for the lost. He is the one then who acts in this way. So when Christ is embraced as the sole bringer of righteousness for us, the sole bringer of righteousness, he becomes a cornerstone. When seen as too narrow, too exclusive, not inclusive enough, he becomes a stumbling stone. And he is a stumbling stone for many in the world these days, is he not? When received by faith alone, he becomes a cornerstone. But when he's seen as an offense to one's own good works, why aren't my good works enough? As a person I met once said, I only want what I deserve at judgment day. Little does he know. When Christ is seen as an offense to one's own good works, he becomes a stumbling stone. When you believe that Christ has atoned for your sin, he becomes a cornerstone. When you say, I don't need anyone to die for me, I'll stand before God as I am. In fact, he's got a lot of splaining to do, as one movie actor said on a talk show recently. Then he becomes a stumbling stone. Which is he for you? Have you come perhaps today to see for the first time that Christ is only and exclusively your source of righteousness, and that faith is the only means by which you acquire that righteousness? And it is. For simple faith in this Christ, his righteousness can be yours. Salvation can be yours. Which is he to you this day? If you haven't, then exercise that faith in Christ. Exercise that faculty of faith that God places in your heart as he brings you to himself. Exercise that faith today in this Christ. And he will come to you and renew you, give you life in God. Well, let us now come to that place where we do continue to receive Christ in faith as he ministers to us by his body and blood in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.